I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, Ian Dark and John Rawling. As always, thanks for the brilliant feedback on the episode we did with the brilliant, the legendary Barry McGuigan. And we are back now talking about all kinds of things to do with boxing broadcasting. And I think we've got some notes here, but I actually did want to break the ice with this one, actually. And I don't know who wants to go with this. But do you remember your first meeting? And just while you ponder this, Ian, I remember our first meeting. I grabbed you off a boat in Denmark at the Tyson Brian Nielsen fight just to grab your opinion on something. And John, I think yours was when you were doing a gig with Glenn McCrory at Ringside, and I knew Glenn and came over and spoke to you both. But do you remember when you first met one another?
I don't exactly. I mean, it would have been, I guess, sort of in the, when would it be, about 1983-84, which is when I first worked in the sports room in London. I went down there and what the BBC call an attachment, which is where you get experience of sort of working at a higher level. And I went down and worked for Radio Sport, as it was, or Radio 2 Sports at the time. And Ian was one of the guys who I, because he was interested in boxing, you know, and he'd come from a similar background to me, from an agency, worked in Leicester, which is where I came down from. We kind of had a lot in common and we just kind of struck it off from word go. And I tell you what, Tris, I always loved Ian's insane sense of humour.
Well, I've never heard it described as that before, but I'll take that as a compliment in a way. It's you're making me sound like some boxing version of Spike Milligan, but I'll take it, John. I'll take it. But one of the things that happened, did this happen to you, John? I think you're right. That is where we first met, in the BBC Radio Sports Room at Broadcasting House. Now, the very first time they put me on the air on national radio, it was on the Pete Murray show. Remember Pete Murray, our radio afternoon, doing the sports desk? And when I came out, Peter Brackley, who was a great funny man, he'd arranged for everybody to be on the phone pretending to be answering complaints from listeners. And he's talking down the phone and saying, well, I thought he was quite good, but I'll pass on the complaint. Yeah. So did they do that? I'm not sure whether they did that to you, John.
No, they didn't do that. I mean, there were some brilliant characters around the sports room in those days, weren't there? Some real sort of larger-than-life characters and some, you know, some great fun people. And we did used to have so many laughs. One of them, actually, from going back into that era, one of them, of course, was Jeff Stelling, who's gone on to become a big noise in football broadcasting. Do you remember, Ian, that he was told by one of the producers, I'll not name them, that he said, your voice isn't good enough, you're never going to make it.
I mean, it was strange, really, that Jeff, I mean, he'd say it himself, he never really became a big stellar name on BBC Radio, but my goodness me, he's made up for it now. He's probably not far off, you know, maybe after Gary Lineker, being the biggest name in sports broadcasting in this country. And great guy, Jeff. He used to play right back, and I was on right midfield in the BBC Radio football team every Sunday morning. I think Jeff, slowest fullback I've ever seen, but he really could use the ball well.
he hadn't got long legs, Jeff, had he?
No, but good guy. I saw him about a year or so ago, and he hasn't changed. So with all that success, that's good to see. It really is. But yeah, going back to those days, do you remember we used to play cricket down the office after we'd done the main sports desk? 7 o'clock at night, we'd have this whole cricket game going on right the way down the length of the office. They couldn't do that now with all the computers and everything around it, but we'd smash the place up. But I think a couple of times the went out the window down to where Radio 1 used to be.
I once literally did smash the place up. There's a guy working for us then who went on to work for many a year for TalkSport called Mark Saggers, who was actually, he actually played for Cambridge. He was a pretty good cricketer, was Mark. And he slipped one down at me. The ball used to be a sort of a rolled up piece of paper with a lot of, a lot of sellotape involved in it. It was quite a hard thing. And this thing, he dropped one short. It was coming towards my head. I went for an almighty hook shot. And of course, the bat slid out of my sweaty palms, crashed into a window. And God knows how much this huge window would have cost, but it was destroyed by a bat actually launched by me. It was one of the more embarrassing phone calls when you have to ring up the maintenance people and say, we've had a small accident in the sports room.
In the middle of one of those cricket games one night, everybody was playing and the controller of Radio 2 came in through the door and nobody knew what to say except Christopher Martin Jenkins, the cricket correspondent, who just looked up and said, "Could you do a silly mid-on, please, sir?" he burst out laughing and on we went. But anyway, we're digressing. It's not much of a chat about boxing, but it is kind of where we grew up in national radio anyway.
Yeah, and John, let me ask you this. Was Ian into impersonations back then as well, or is this a relatively new phenomenon?
No, he was into all sorts. I mean, there were a lot of people then who were funny in their own rights, but Ian was always into that. And I tell you something else that he had a reputation for. I'm not sure Ian had even known this. I think it was Mike Lewis, who was the head of sport at the time, told me this. He said, "Ian comes up with an amazing number of ideas when you're doing a program, when you're doing desks, whatever." And he said, "Most of them are absolute crap." But he said, "You get the odd one, which is an absolute jewel." And he said, and you just have to be aware that sooner or later, there's one which comes up, which was absolutely brilliant. And I do remember, even at those early days, I mean, Ian had enormous respect from his fellow broadcasters.
I won't name names, but what you just said there, John, reminds me of someone who told me about a chap I was going to interview for a magazine last year. And someone said, "Be careful, he will talk and talk and talk, but he will drop the occasional pearl that you've got to scoop up and then make the best of it." So you might be on the phone a couple of hours, but you might get 5 minutes worth of great content.
I don't remember all those ideas, and if I did, I don't think many of them got used. So John's story is probably true. When John came down, he said he came down on an attachment, which is basically a trial to see whether they like you. And I think it was pretty clear they liked John. So he was always going to go on to big things.
So I found this interesting, obviously, as well. John, you've ended up splitting your time you've obviously been a mainstay for The Guardian and then obviously radio and TV. Did you have one goal in mind at the start? Was it one or the other, or did you start juggling from the minute that you started to make it?
Do you know, I don't think people really should have that sort of grand ambition. Maybe if you've been the England centre forward like Gary, you know, you have a chance of going on to do what he's done. But the mere mortals like Ian and I don't think it's really like that. You know, you bob along. We came through regional newspapers, then working for a news agency in the Midlands, then on to local radio, then to national radio. And you don't sort of have grand designs, I don't think, because if you do, you're going to get thwarted and you're going to get frustrated. I think really, as a broadcaster, I'd say to anybody who fancies doing it, I know the landscape's changed since the days when we came into it, but really it's kind of an elongated yes-no interlude. You know, do you fancy doing this? Can you do this? And even though there's a little cowardly person on one shoulder which says, "No, you're not up to that, don't do it," on the other shoulder, you've got one which says, "Come on, give it a go." And you give it a go, and you either sink or swim. And I think pretty much that's what, well, certainly my broadcasting career has been like. You know, you get given the openings, you get given the options, and you have to seize them and try not to make too big a cock up.
I think it's a bit like John Lennon said, isn't it, in the song, life is what happens to you while you're busy making other plans. I mean, it certainly worked that way for me. I never had any real thought that I'd be good enough to work beyond local radio. Well, I didn't think I was good enough to work on the radio full stop. You know, from Radio Leicester, I was delighted to be working for the BBC just then, let alone progressing up to national radio level. And you feel in awe when you walk into Broadcasting House and you see all famous names passing you in the corridor, people like Robin Day and John Humphreys and that kind of thing, let alone the big names that were hanging around at BBC Radio Sport, who we'd all listened to growing up, like Brian Butler and Peter Jones and Desmond Lynham. And talking of Des, I got to work with him quite early in my career at BBC Radio because he was just about to break into TV and become the kind of superstar that he did become. But he was the radio boxing commentator, and as TV were using him more and more, he was not able to do all the fights, which is how I got to get the gig. You know, and I remember traveling abroad with him to Houston to cover Pat Caldell and Salvador Sanchez. You know, the late great Salvador Sanchez, so sadly died in the road accident. But you know, I remember about that Des being frightened of flying. You know, he's put his head back as we were taking off and said, "Don't say anything." He said, "The first 40 seconds are the worst." Like, he was okay after that. But you know, there was something I didn't know about him. I remember playing golf with Des in Houston ahead of that fight. And we were both absolutely awful. We nearly broke the windscreens of about 20 cars going past. And six holes because it was that embarrassing.
Wow. Well, I think the thing is, you know, I always thought this, and I remember going for the job at Boxing News when there were a couple of hundred applicants when Claude was hiring. And I just thought that someone's got to do it. So they need the position filled, and it's going to be someone. And obviously, you know, you need to be able to bring something different to the table or something that they value, but the position's got to be filled in some way, shape or form. And I suppose for anyone listening, what I'm trying to get at is there's that, you know, if the position needs to be filled, then as long as you work your socks off, then if an opening comes up, you'll be ready for it. And let me ask you, oh, go on, Ian, have you got anything to add to that?
I'm just thinking, now, I was thinking of one or two people who we used to work with in those days, though, who clearly weren't cut out to be anywhere near broadcasting national sport. We had one bloke who came and worked on the local radio desk in there, who shouted out in front of all these esteemed broadcasters, "Does Liam Brady play for Arsenal?" I mean, he was the biggest player in the country at the time. Talk about losing all your credibility in one sentence. Oh, he was right there and then. Everybody looked at each other and thought, he's not going to be here much longer. And he was. I think he was very good unit, though, later on. Very good on finances. As long as he was nowhere near Liam Brady, he was fine.
That's great stuff. That's great. And so, John, obviously, we talked about these, you know, your plethora of gigs, whether it's agencies or staff jobs. I mean, one thing I'm not sure about, how did the Guardian job come about in the first place? Was that, did you start freelancing for them, stringing for them, or how did that work?
Well, Harry Mullen, I think, was the one who put a word in for me. I used to get on very well socially with Harry, and he was one of your predecessors of Boxing News, people who aren't aware, who sadly passed away when he was just 52, 53 years old, which is tragic, really. But he was a lovely writer. And I used to get on very well with Harry, and he'd sort of shoved me in for one or two bits of freelancing here and there. And I'd been able to swing one or two little broadcasting gigs in his direction alongside me doing a bit of radio and a bit of early television, a little thing called Wire TV, which existed for a while. And Harry put a word in with the Guardian editor for me, I think. And before, you know, I know where it was, they were on the phone to me saying, "Look, would you like to do it?" And of course, I guess from their point of view, I was a cheap option because I'd be going along to these fights on the other side of the Atlantic and all the big fights over here with expenses paid for by the BBC, who in those days weren't really too worried about the finances in the way that they are now. So I was picking up, you know, sort of stringer money from the Guardian over and above my over and above my BBC work. So it worked for me, and it worked for The Guardian as well. So that's kind of how it happened. But yeah, I did actually used to love the writing game. It's changed very much now because of social media and because of electronic communication. So it has to be very much more immediate than it was then. It used to be possible to do a commentary on a fight and then disappear off and write your piece and file it in the early hours of the morning to some copy taker back home in London, whereas now it's wanted more or less immediately. So I don't think it would be possible to do what I did then. But I used to get a real buzz out of writing for The Guardian. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it enormously. And I sometimes think that when you put things down in word form, it had more of an impact sometimes than your voice as a commentator in either radio or TV. I know Ian would remember when you went away on those overseas fights, Ian, they used to collect all the cuttings for you, didn't they, to go through them. And yeah. I remember you sometimes quoted back to me, you know, sort of one or two things I'd said, and you sort of said, "Are you really sure you ought to be saying that?"
Well, I remember, John, when you were in that spell where you were writing for The Guardian, we were in fights in Las Vegas. I mean, it did you a great favour because it kept you out the bars, didn't it? You were so busy. You were doing all the radio stuff. You know, and I'd say to you, "Oh, do you fancy a little sort of early evening drink?" "No, I've got to go off and file my copy now for The Guardian." And you were working sort of like 24/7, it seemed to me, to get that stuff out. But, you know, I've kept the lovely piece you wrote about Harry Mullen when he died. I've still got that in the drawer. So, yeah, I mean, not trying to be too complimentary to John, because we don't do that kind of thing usually. But yeah,
you take the piss out of each other.
Stuff during that time on boxing.
Yeah, of course. And then obviously people see what we do in our various roles as obviously a hugely glamorous life, in the sense that you meet all these top athletes, sports stars, fighters, footballers, and so forth. And I suppose, you know, this is the why, right? This is the why we get into this, because we think it is that, and that's all it is, right? Is that right to you as well, Ian? I suppose the more cynical ones would say that we're failed athletes and failed sports stars, yep, in our own right. But it's a way to get close and follow our passion. I suppose that's how I'd justify it.
I think a psychologist would have a field day with most of us, to be honest with you. You know, why do we do this, really? I don't know. It's a bit like a drug. I really do think that. Sometimes now, when I go to a sporting event and I'm not commentating, I almost feel like I should be doing this. There's a sort of little inner self which says, "I'd like to talk about this and express my view to it." And I'm pretty sure I bore the guy next door to me down at Portsmouth Football Club, you know, with my attempted analysis of games. And he gives me a bit of an old fashioned look halfway through the game, but sort of he kind of tolerates me. But it's hard not to do it. You know, it's hard to watch it now as a fan. But, you know, let's be honest about it. I think everybody who's been in front of a microphone or a camera or even the writing side of it as well, there's a little bit of ego attached to it. Yes, we did all dream, I think, as kids that we'd be big sports stars one day, and we weren't good enough. And this is the next best thing. I know that's a bit of a cliche, but it's true.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. You know, I mean, what I really wanted to do as a young lad was be a professional cricketer, but I was hopeless. You know, I be a great athlete, and I was an okay athlete, but I was never going to be anywhere near a great athlete. And and this kind of is the next best thing. And actually, when the more you get into it, the more you work within the industry, and you're covering major events, great fights, Olympic games, you know, football matches. In Ian's case, you get a huge buzz out of being involved in something that you know has been terrific. And I don't know about you, Ian, but I have always been my own harshest critic. I know when I've had a not very good night, and likewise, I know when I've done okay. And it gives you a real buzz when you know you've nailed it.
You just reminded me of a great line, being at a boxing press conference one day, and I can't remember the fighter, but he said, you know something, he goes, I'm my own worst critic in there. And the trainer of the other guy said, not while I'm around, you're not. which I thought was really fast and clever. But we do analyze what we do. I don't really like ever listening back to myself, because I always think commentary is of the moment that it happened in. You'll sometimes hear an old clip of something you did played back on the radio or TV and kind of wince a little bit, because it doesn't sound right, or just sounds overexcited, you know, played in the cold light of day, maybe a year or so later. I mean, the only one I'm kind of a bit proud of is, like John, I commentated on athletics for BBC Radio, and I called that race in Seoul, the Olympics, the dirtiest race in history, as it's been labelled, the 100-metre final, where Ben Johnson beats Carl Lewis and, you know, leaves scorch marks on the track doing it. Of course, you know, as we well know now, he was on rocket fuel to do it, but we didn't know that at the time. But my commentary of that lives on, and I hear that every Olympic Games played back, and I thought, yeah, I didn't do a bad job on that one.
You don't That's have great. Too long to think, do you, with a sprint? So when you've got, I don't know, you've got the few seconds where you're setting it up, or maybe a minute or so where you're setting it up and trying to build the drama. And then you just have to go with a real seat of your pants reaction sort of commentary. And on radio particularly, you don't get a second chance. If you don't nail it, you've blown it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's just... I've ever been commentating on any sport right the way through my career, sitting there just ahead of that final, which had had the most tremendous build-up. It was the centerpiece of that whole Olympic Games, this race. And a little voice in my head was saying, don't mess this up, kid, because it could be pretty terminal for your career if you do. This is how your job at this Olympic Games is going to be remembered. So luckily it came out all right. I mean, John will know this because he's called, you know, thousands of races himself. It was an easy race to call because Johnson skated way clear. I mean, what you feared was a photo finish and calling the wrong winner, that kind of thing. And all the time I had to keep my eye on Linford Christie, who was the big hope for Britain. And, you know, he got the bronze medal, and luckily I picked that up as well. So, you know, that was one of the good days. And as John said, you're very proud, really, to provide the soundtrack to some great moments in sport. But, you know, there's a lot of things that don't go right as well.
Because, hold on, just to get that right, I mean, in terms of this 100 metres, and John, you'll relate to this, but I remember when I did a course in radio and journalism, they said that, you know, on radio, you're basically speaking at 3 words per second. Which seemed to be sort of what they said was, you know, the industry standard. Maybe this is for less excitable talk, but that basically gives you 30 words to describe the biggest sporty event of the year, which is nothing, is it? You know what, you can't say there's no room for or anything like that.
No,
there's no umming and erring. Absolutely, that's not an option. But you know, sometimes, Trez, it actually stretches you and tests you more when it's a dull race, or when it's a dull fight. You know, how do you commentate on a walking event out there on the road? And that's when, you know, sort of the light and shade of commentary comes in, and a few little anecdotes and a few little lines and a rapport with the guy who's sitting alongside you is absolutely important, because you need to make the listener, as well as keep them informed, you need to keep them entertained and hopefully get them to smile. I think the worst commentators are the ones who are a bit, you know, sort of tablets of stone and don't have any light and shade in there.
Yeah, I mean, John's hit the nail on the head there. If I was ever auditioning a young commentator, I'd hand him, you know, for boxing, let's say, you'd hand him a tape of a very deadly dull fight for an inconsequential title that when the whole 12 rounds and all 12 rounds were just about the same. That often happens, happily, mostly on undercards, not on the main fight on the bill. So you would see whether that commentator could build in some entertainment into his commentary there and find subplots that engage the listeners and viewers. not everybody could, but John's right. There is a need there for you to be take over the entertainment value almost without putting on a vaudeville show, of course. But, you know, I remember doing one fight and saying, do you know what? Have there been any good films on lately, Glenn? About the seventh round.
You know, that's great.
We just did it as an aside. I said, "You seen any good movies lately?"
And sometimes it can. Sometimes, Triz, it can be those fights which get enormous audiences. I remember back in 2005, Danny Williams and Audley Harrison, the first time they fought in, I think it was December 2005, which was a big thing on ITV at the time, and we got an audience. I remember. Commentator myself and Duke McKenzie, the audience was in excess of 8 million, which was huge for boxing. And it was one of the worst fights you'd ever see. And that's when you're really tested as a commentator. Can you try and keep a bit of interest going when what's in front of you is an absolute stinker? You have to tell the truth, but also you don't have to be so truthful that you're telling the whole world to turn over and watch something else.
Well, that's a key point, of course, because you work for producers and editors. There are a lot of TV choices people have. You know, they've got the remote in their hands. They can switch channels. So it is kind of your job as well to keep people glued to your event. So even if it's dull, I used to try to make a point of giving people the impression that maybe the drama's still to come in this fight. We've seen fights like this before where, you know, it's been like this and then it's become quite explosive later on. Of course, I didn't ever think it was going to become explosive later on, but it was almost very rarely. But it was like a bit of a trick of the trade, maybe, to just make people look forward rather than just say, well, why am I watching this then? And, you know, what's on ITV?
There's a very well-known boxing producer who still has a prominent role in the sport right now. And he's a very, very funny guy, broad Yorkshire accent. And he always used to say, we're in the business of polishing turds.
Thing with sport, isn't it? You can't choreograph the action. You can give it all the big build up, you know, all week. You can promote the hell out of it. You can interview the fighters and write great previews and do preview shows and countdown shows till you're blue in the face. But the action, you have no control over. So it could turn out to be, you know, edge of the seat thriller or a complete bore. But you've got to be prepared for both.
Well, I've got this recent example in my head, and it's maybe because we've gone off piste a little bit talking about other sports, but I think there's plenty of value in that anyway, is the recent World Cup final with France and Argentina, right? With Argentina 2-0 up and apparently sailing away, I drifted out of the game after about an hour or 65 minutes thinking, well, this is in the bag. And then obviously, you know, I get a text from my daughter 15 minutes later saying, you need to come down now, it's 2-2. You know, and it's game on, but you know, you can't tell. And John, I think if I'm right in thinking, with that Audley Harrison fight, which I was at, I think it was at the XL, there was a little sting in the tail late on because Danny did drop Audley, didn't he? And I think there was, I think possibly at the end of near the end of that fight, I don't think he stopped him or got him out of there, but I think he put him down, which was an exclamation mark on his victory. So you got to stay invested in it, even if you think that. And I mean, the worst fight I ever saw was Fraser Quendo against John Ruiz at Madison Square Garden, and nothing happened for 11 and a half rounds. And then Ruiz burst into action. It was all over 6 seconds later. And, you know, nothing had happened for 11 and a half rounds, but one flurry later and bang, it was all over.
Well, I suppose that's what keeps us hooked on boxing, or one of the things that keeps us hooked, isn't it? Because it's an old truism. It only takes one.
Yeah. And end any second, can't it? They could, you know, an equal out of nowhere. So that's part of the drama, and I think it's one of the things people love about boxing, that it is theatrical. But thinking about those old nights covering fights, sometimes I'd have to commentate on about 3 hours of the undercard, knowing that nearly all of it wasn't going to get to the air. So I can admit it, I think, now. We used to play some, you know, we used to have some little games of our own And remember John MacDonald, who used to do the emceeing?
Still does the darts.
Challenge me and say, you've got to get the words, some words into the commentary. So it, the one of them one week was pork sausages. I had to get pork sausages into a commentary of an undercard fight. I said, okay. I said, I'll do that. But you, when this guy Sergei Devakov gets in the ring, I think he was Ukrainian, actually. Was he? Yeah. I said, you've got to introduce him as smoking Sergei Devakov. So that was our little game. So I managed to do the pork sausages line because there was some bloke from Wolverhampton on the undercard. And I said, it's not so easy for these fighters coming through these days. I said, they used to get sponsorship from, you know, their local butcher who'd give them some steak or pork sausages or something like that along the way. So, MacDonald kept his side of the bargain and introduced him as smoking Sergei Devakov. Now, the sequel to this, and I'm not, this really happened. The next time he came over, because he used to fight, didn't he, a bit in England as like a journeyman opponent. The next time he fought, he came in wearing a gown saying smoking Sergei Devakov. And he told John MacDonald he liked the nickname.
That's great. So let's get to some bests and worsts. I mean, what are the best things about the gig? Is it literally just meeting these A-list athletes and watching these spectacular sporting occasions? Is that what we're looking at, Ian? That's, you know, that's the pinnacle for us, really, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah, I think, you know, ringside seat at history. And I think with boxing, you can probably get closer and on the inside track of boxing more than any other sport that I've ever covered. Nobody's really trying to keep you at arm's length. Maybe it was hard to get near to Mike Tyson in the peak of his fame because he had a lot of heavy people around him. But most of the time, you can mix with the trainers. You can talk to the boxers themselves. They're usually freely available. So you really have a built up a very, very good kind of, I always think we're like a sponge. You're getting all these ideas in. I might chat with you in the bar, Tris or John, and then John will have a good idea and maybe something will happen in the middle of the fight and you'll bring that out. So, I mean, it's fantastic fun and a privilege to be able to do that and provide that soundtrack and hope that you're reading it right for people at home. But the difficult thing with boxing, the plus is that access. The difficult thing is, of course, it's one of those sports where you don't actually know who's winning, that you've got to give people your idea of who's winning. And I've heard some people try to opt out of that, who tried commentary. You can't. You've got to give them what you think is happening in the fight and who might be ahead in it, even if that proves to be wrong with some questionable judging.
Yeah, I go along with that. I remember when I first went across and started working for ITV, there was because when you work on radio, you get used to interpreting it as you go along and you're giving your point of view about how you think, you're trying to second guess the judges, how you think it's going. And I remember somebody at ITV said, John, you want to just step back from that. That's let Duke do that. You know, he was effectively told, you know, sort of hang Duke McKenzie out to dry. Don't put your neck on the block, which was a little bit harsh on Duke. He fortunately, more often than not, he got it right.
Yeah, so, but I think one of the dangers is you can, I think we've talked about this before, the two of you can sit there and the guy alongside you might be seeing the fight a little bit differently to you. And that can happen. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a pretty subjective business, what you're seeing and what you like in a fight. I think you've got to be careful and, you know, have one or two bad nights where you kind of get lured down the wrong path and you're starting to call the fight probably quite wrongly or not seeing an aspect of it that maybe the judges are. So that's quite complicated. I remember doing the Hay Valuev fight. You remember that man mounted Nikolai Valuev when Hay beat him that night? Not a lot happened in the fight, really. And Jim Watt was alongside me. And Jim kept making the point in the fight. He said, I don't think Hay's doing enough to take away this title. And he'd said that about 10 times. And about the eighth round, I thought, well, I think I'm going to have to come back here. And I said, yeah, I said, but what's Valuev doing to keep it, Jim? But that was not to argue with Jim. He knows, you know, more than I'll ever know about boxing, but just to open up the other side of the argument for the viewers.
Yeah, it's a tough position because, like you said, you're blind until the scorecards come out, and then obviously it doesn't matter what you've seen anyway, because the chances are in boxing in the current climate, you've got it wrong anyway. Sorry, John.
I was just going to say social media can be pretty brutal in that respect, can't it? You know, I mean, every commentator gets a load of flack from armchair sort of experts who are sitting making their views known on social media. And sometimes somebody says something who's relatively prominent in the sport and people leap in on the back of that. There can be a bit of a lynch mob mentality. It can get a little bit like Monty Python and the Life of Brian, can't it? You know, when everybody's going along for a stoning when they step out of when they step out of line.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Always, Twitter reminds me of that song by Boy George and Culture Club called "Church of the Poisoned Mind." It feels a bit like that sometimes on there. I mean, you're right. You can take a hammering whether you're right or wrong, and nearly always will. And I think that's something the old commentators, like Harry Carpenter, Reg Guttridge, you know, they didn't have to put up with that. But my view of it is, don't go and look at the notifications on your Twitter account after the fight, because you're not probably going to like it.
So, Ian, you mentioned something earlier, by the way, if you don't mind me just rewinding about 20 minutes. When we talked about someone doing the job and it's about ego and stuff, it's very different now, though, to getting into the sport, because you guys are celebrities in the world, right? You guys are celebrities. You've got big followings and have been around for ages. But when you got into this business, the idea wasn't to become a celebrity. It was to cover sport. But now I think people are wanting to emulate you to have a high profile themselves and to be famous. And I think that when you talk about ego, I think there's a different, just trying to phrase it correctly, there's a different, the motive is somewhat different. When I went into journalism, I never thought about any kind of fame or posterity. I just thought about going and covering fights and events and speaking to and interviewing celebrities. There was no such thing as social media, so you wouldn't take photos and post them anywhere because it wasn't a thing. So it's the landscape's changed. So the ego thing behind it, the ego motive is I think different now to what it was then. John, do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I think it's probably made it I agree. It's the perspective, isn't it? You know, I mean, some people, I find it slightly pathetic that people go along and do interviews or say something or whatever, and they're always trying to project themselves on social media at the center of things. There are one or two boxing reporters who do thus ad nauseum, and it becomes extremely tedious. You know, you sort of think, well, hang on, you know, you're just doing your job. It's not about you. I think that sporting coverage and the sports media has become lessened to an extent by the development of social media. I think it's changed newspaper journalism, and it's certainly changed the way in which people approach it.
Yeah, and I think we've got to always resist being fans with microphones or notebooks as well. I mean, you talked about you attain a kind of celebrity. I wouldn't really call it celebrity. I mean, people know what we do. If it is a celebrity, it's a kind of D-list celebrity.
We won't get you in the jungle anytime soon, Lenny.
But I'm not going anywhere near those spiders and snakes. God, how people do that. That's another world. But so it's a complicated world. And I do understand young guys trying to break through. You know, there are a lot more people now doing what we do, commentary. And so to get noticed and stand out from the crowd, I do understand why they want to do that, go on social media, push themselves. It does feel a bit like the art of the self-publicist at times. But, you know, it's complex because there are producers and editors in our business now who judge you by how many followers you've got and that kind of thing. They're making decisions based on that rather more than what you're actually producing on air. So it's a complicated environment and landscape now. And I do have some sympathy with the new generation of broadcasters coming through. they've got to get themselves noticed somehow.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think you guys have provided real balance with that. I think the thing is, I'm obviously quite an old school guy, and so my whole thing is, it's not about me. It's about the fighters and the trainers and the promoters, and the managers who I cover. No one tunes into Boxing Life Stories to hear me. They want to hear the people that are the guests. You know, it's their forum to tell their story, and that's kind of how.
It's, but I think when people listen to you doing that, you do acquire a kind of great respect and reverence within the boxing community as the guy who's obviously pushing the right buttons and getting the answers and getting the full narrative out there properly with each person you interview. So yeah, it's a kind of, it rubs off. You become a kind of a star in the way that, say, Graham Norton becomes a big star, even though the people he's interviewing much bigger celebrities per se.
Sure. I get what you're saying. I get what you're both saying, to be honest. And I think, you know, I see the people, you know, shouting from the rooftops about what they're doing, who they're doing it with, and all the rest of it. And like you said, Ian, it can't be denied that they catch the eye of some of the big wigs at the networks and the radio stations and all the rest of it. So I suppose it's a way of them advertising themselves. And, you know, I'm not going to hate on what they're doing, because they've got to adapt to the situation. It's just a different way of reporting. We're not the story, the way I see it. We're not the story. It's not about us.
Yeah, I mean, and it's the same with a press conference for a fight. Nowadays, nearly all of them have to have some kind of gimmicky, manufactured confrontation. Sometimes it's not manufactured. Sometimes it is a genuine grudge. But, you know, and then you'll get columnists writing that boxing's name was dragged through the mud again by this incident at the press conference. And I'm reading it and thinking, but you wouldn't even be writing about this fight if that hadn't happened. So there's a kind of hypocrisy there. They've done their job, because now everybody knows that fighter A is fighting fighter B in 3 weeks' time at the O2 Arena. And you were only going to give it two lines if that hadn't happened. So there's a bit of double there.
John, best bits of the gig for you?
Well, what you mean, the actual broadcast or the whole experience? I mean, the whole experience. Well, I used to get a huge buzz out of just traveling the world at somebody else's expense to see fantastic sporting events, whether it be world title fights, Olympic Games, or whatever. You know, I mean, there's not too many parts of the world that I haven't seen at one time or another as a result of covering sport. And I think that's a huge privilege. And I think that people who cover sport, they sometimes need to just take the blinkers off a tiny bit. And even in the modern era, where things have to be so immediate and you're kind of on call 24/7 to give your reaction, I think you still have to find time to take the blinkers off. You know, if you're in Rome, go and look at Rome. If you're in New York, see New York. Don't just see the fight and nothing else. You've got to take in the whole experience. And I think that traveling and meeting people from all sorts of different countries and different cultures is a wonderful privilege. And it's something that I've absolutely loved doing over the years.
Yeah, and you can get a bit about it, can't you, as well? You start moaning about planes not being on time and all that kind of thing. We've all done that. So, it is a privilege, and we should always remember that.
Yeah. And how about the worst moments? And Ian, I'll start with you on this. I suppose it's easy to get to boxing and think, oh yeah, worst moments are ring fatalities and injuries, but I'm not really talking about that. I'm talking about of the job of being a broadcaster. What are the worst parts of it? I suppose the social media thing has to be part of it, because it leaves you second guessing yourself every 5 minutes.
Well, having just said that, where you can get blasé and start moaning about it, probably travel is one of the pains, because that's the bit people don't see, that you might be covering some fight up in Middlesbrough or somewhere, and you're driving sort of half the night to get home again through pouring rain, or you know, you're trying to catch a train that isn't going. There's all that sort of thing attached to it. But you say don't talk about the ring tragedies, but that is the worst part of boxing. And I was unfortunate enough to be there, and it certainly the very worst night of all nights James Murray and Drew Doherty. You know, and James Murray lost his life that night, and it was like a sickening, sickening night because you could see him in the ring, so obviously struggling, and you thought this guy is probably dying. And there was a riot going on with people throwing chairs and stuff around with the guy lying in the ring and the medics trying to treat him. So that was a night, I must admit, I walked away out there and thought, well, can I carry on doing this? Can you, in all conscience, do this much longer? And I had to go and interview James Murray's father at his home a day or two later as well. And I started it off by saying, look, you don't have to do this. You don't have to do this interview at all. You know, he said, no, I want to. I want to talk about my son. So he did very bravely talk about his son. But yeah, I can't let your question go without giving you that answer. Because, I had to pretty deep into my conscience, really, to carry on after that.
Yeah, John, have you had moments like that?
Absolutely. I'd add that one. I mean, one of the best fights I ever saw and ever commentated on simply has to be Nigel Benn and Gerald McClellan. But what happened to Gerald as a result of that fight, and Nigel was never the same fighter again after that night in 1995, but what happened to Gerald McClellan actually made me question, do I really want to be carrying on in this? It was just sort of such a terrifying atmosphere, a fight of such horrific intensity. And you sort of... The gladiatorial aspect of it is something that attracts you to boxing. But then when you see it reduced to its most primeval level, to its basic level like that, it does rather make you question whether or not you want to be a part of it. I mean, obviously, I asked the question and continued, you know. And when Ben fought McClellan the following week, I think Steve Collins was fighting Chris Eubank over in Ireland. So we had to come off the horse and get straight back in the saddle for the fight because the sport goes on. But when you have something like that, it really does make you wonder.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we've talked about best and worst, and obviously that's a sad note, the worst ones, and it was always sort of going to go that way, I guess. I think I'll never forget the first fight where I think I was at where someone was injured, and it was actually Gilbert Eastman, and I remember the word coming back to ringside, and you hope it's Chinese whispers, but it's the thing you all dread where someone comes to you and says, fighter A has collapsed in the dressing room. Mm. And then, you know, your heart literally sinks to the soles of your feet and you're completely powerless, helpless, and start questioning things. Your mind goes a million miles an hour thinking, oh, no, this isn't the night where we have one of these, is it? It's a horrendous feeling and something that, fortunately, we don't have to deal with too much. In terms of moving into a slightly more cheery segue, I hope you guys are armed with some embarrassing moments. I'm not sure if there's many that you would admit to. Ian, any ones that spring to mind, moments of embarrassment, wrong names, wrong places, wrong time?
In boxing, no doubt about it. It was the night Prince Nassim Hamed won the title in Cardiff against Robinson. I basically didn't see that left hook with which he finished the contest because I don't know whether it was a post, it was just the angle, but You watch back the commentary of that, and I've totally missed it. I mean, I've called the result of the fight and the fact that Robinson's down, but I haven't seen the punch. So I'm pretty sheepish about that. And I had Chris Brown, who was our editor back then, saying to me back at the hotel, are you okay? Is everything all right? Have you got some medical problem? I said, no. I said, I just didn't see it. I said, it was the angle. So there was...
I'm blind.
Yeah. There was one in football when I'm calling a goal between... Oldham Newcastle game back in the 90s, and then Newcastle had a goalkeeper called Mike Hooper in goal. He was playing a blind. He was saving everything, and I said, "Do you know what this goalkeeper?" I said, "He's having a wonderful night out there, but he should know his angles. He's got a degree in maths." And then I left the gap and thought, "No, that's not right." I thought, "Or is it English literature? I can't remember."
I remember once in athletics, you know, I mean, one athletic stadium is pretty much like another. And I can remember once being in, I was actually in Budapest, which is one of the most beautiful cities in Europe. It's a fabulous place to visit. And I was sitting in the stadium, and they came across to me and I said, yeah, good afternoon and welcome back to... to look at the guy alongside me. I think it was Mike Whittingham. And basically say, where am I? Completely forgotten which bloody city I was in. But talk about embarrassment. I mean, I'm sure Ian would remember this very clearly. Back in the late 80s, we were working alongside each other. Ian was commentating. We probably had Tony Adamson or Peter Jones or somebody presenting the show. And I was there as the ring interviewer. And it was the night that Jimmy Mack had his fight against Azuma Nelson, and he had been insanely brave, Jim McDonnell, but ultimately lost the fight. And my job is to interview the fighters, so I'm up in the ring, and Barry Hearn had said to me, as the promoter that night, he'd said, no, don't go anywhere near. And I'm just standing there with my microphone, and of course I know Jim very well, and I'd been involved in all the build-up and everything. And Jim comes across and starts, effectively, he comes across and almost gets hold of the microphone and starts wanting to talk to his fans and apologise that he's not produced quite the greatest night of his life. Well, anyway, of course, Barry sees this, and maybe it was naive on my part. I should have perhaps just kept the microphone away from Jim. And one of Barry's heavies came and physically lifted me up, practically threw me out of the ring. And I think I landed on the broadcast table in front of where Ian and Henry Cooper were sitting broadcasting. That was a fairly embarrassing moment.
Yeah, that was nasty that night. I mean, you could have been quite badly hurt that night, John.
Yeah. Well, if I had been, I wouldn't have had to work anymore. I could have just sued their ass off. But then, hey, ho.
So, Ian, you said something actually. It reminds me of a recent podcast I did with judge or referee Kenny Bayless. And he was telling me how he was the third man in the ring for Hopkins De La Hoya. And Hopkins won with a body shot, and Bayless was the ref, and he didn't see it. He holds his hands up and didn't see the body shot. He sees Oscar writhing around on the canvas and picks up the count and counts him out. And he goes over to the corner and says, well, did I get it right? Was it a punch? Because he had no idea what it was. There's no, you know, there was no VAR or anything else. He was sort of doing it blindly, which, you know, what can you do? I mean, in that situation, if you miss it, I mean, I'd rather be in your shoes and miss something than his, that's for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, James, that was one of the great body punches. I still remember that now. That was a fabulous shot from Hopkins.
I mean, I remember doing another one. Now we're talking about these embarrassing moments, and I can't remember the names, but it was deep on an undercard in Vegas. And they said, well, you're only going to have to start commentating really when we get to this part of the bill. And then suddenly I got this instruction to start pick up the commentary on the fight that was in the ring at the moment. I didn't even know who it was. So Bob Mee hands me, who worked with us. I mean, Bob saved our lives many times with his brilliance and his knowledge. So he gave me, sort of, he said, one of the fighters is like, Bob, you know, gave me a name and a bit of a record. But I commentated for the first minute, not knowing who the other bloke in the ring was. Until Bob scribbled something, you know, that he'd found out very quickly at ringside. This is ridiculous, really. Fighter X.
Who's giving quite a good account of himself.
The other one was, here's the crazy one. There'd been some dispute with Frank Warren and Sky over the rights to an undercard fight. And I think it was a night where I think it was Hatton on the undercard of whatever the bill was. And Frank was came up to me as a commentator halfway through the night. He said, you haven't got the rights to commentate on that Hatton fight. I said, well, my producer's telling me to do it, Frank. I said, so, you know, I have to listen to my producer. So I'm going to do the commentary. So Frank installed three security guys to stand in front of me between me and the ring. Me and Jim Watt, so we couldn't see the fight. So I just started commentating off the monitor instead on it. there was nothing they could do about that. And I carried on commentating on it. And Frank had to say, he did smile at the end of it and said, oh, well, you managed to do that quite well. We'll sort out the other stuff later. And I couldn't resist saying to him, Frank, I said, is there some other fights where you could put some people in front of me so I don't have to see them?
I've actually got, so there's a bit of disclosure here, actually. Talk about embarrassing moments, and you guys have dredged it up from my memory bank, and it's never seen the light of day. No one's ever heard this story. Back when I was graduating from uni, I was living with my ex-girlfriend at the time, and I was writing letters for jobs. And of course, there were only two games in town for Boxing News and Boxing Monthly. So I typed out my letters to Claude and the late Lynn Leach and signed them. And I said, just said to my other half, the ink's drying on them. Can you send them off today? I'm going to go and work. So sent them off. I didn't expect to hear a thing. This was in a period when I was writing for, probably, John, in all the Guardians that you were writing on a Monday, there was a Monday Guardian with the job section, wasn't there? So I would be going through the Guardian, applying for dozens of jobs. Anyway, these letters are gone and long forgotten, and Claude never got back to me. And then I got a letter with a Boxing Monthly stamp on it. And this is a terrible story. And I was like, oh, filled with hope and expectation. I was like, God, what are the odds that they needed someone that's just graduated? And I open it up, and it's a handwritten letter from Glenn Leach, and I must have it somewhere because I would never have thrown it away. And it's the most angry scrawl I'd ever seen. And he was lambasting me for sending a letter to him calling him Claude. So my other half had swapped the letters over by mistake and sent Glyn's to Claude and Claude's to Glyn. And Glyn was absolutely laying waste to me with the written word, saying, how dare you write to me like this? This is the least you could do is get this right. And now you've wiped out 50% of your future.
God.
And your girlfriend had wiped out your relationship.
Well, I mean, yeah, what can you do? It was one of those things where, you just obviously think, I should have just done it myself, and obviously that's why you don't delegate.
Didn't you end it, Tris, by saying to him, but any chance of the job, though?
I tell you what, I was shaking reading it. I could see how much he was fuming about it. And actually, obviously, Glyn and I, when I was editor of Boxing News and he was editor of Boxing Monthly, became quite firm friends. And I went to his funeral and wrote his obituary in Boxing Monthly, of all places. So even if you make a gigantic cock up, there's still hope that 10 years down the line, a door might swing open for you. I suppose that was a deeply embarrassing moment to get that wrong when you have a 50-50 chance and they get mixed up like that. Jen, so just one to finish on. We talked about the travel game a little bit here. I suppose if I was giving anyone travel tips, it's always leave 3 hours too early than 10 minutes too late and try and rush it. That would be my biggest tip. Do you guys have anything that springs to mind?
Sometimes in the old days when you went to Vegas, there weren't any direct flights. You had to go. It was a 14-hour door-to-door thing, and rather alarmingly, that the pilot would say, we're just going over Las Vegas now on our way to Los Angeles, where we'd have to go through immigration, change, and arrive in Las Vegas, which we'd just flown over about 8 hours before that. So it was a long-winded journey, but like we said before, a lot of people would give their right arm, wouldn't they, to be going to Vegas to cover a fight. So who were we to moan about it? But
I think we were lucky as well that we were in an era, Ian, where we could find time to sniff out some pretty good restaurants, eat well, have a couple of glasses of wine, and have the sort of chats that we're, sort of sharing on this Ringside Rewind series with a wider audience. We were able to do that over a glass of wine and have so many great laughs and so many great memories. And chatting like this, it brings all of that back. It was, at the time, I think that yourself, me, Bob Mee, Jim Watts, Glenn McCrory, and others. We kind of thought it would never end, but sadly it did. But what a fantastic memory we actually have of those days.
You didn't like all the restaurants, though, John.
No.
Do you remember the one at Paris with your
going back
fish,
into the green slime?
The green slime, yeah.
That's become an ingredient of Ringside Rewind now that people often adhere to. Very much like my recent book Warrior. What do you need to do about that?
Well, buy it now.
Buy it right. I have bought it and it's very good.
Brilliant. Thanks, John.
I haven't yet, but I'm going to read it. Yeah.
Practice as you preach. Buy it now.
Yeah, buy it.
Gents, as always, a huge amount of fun. Loads. In fact, we had even more to do. We'll catch up with them. The remainder of the questions another time. I think as well, you guys have produced the links of the three best fights that you've covered, and they're three separate fights apiece. So maybe that's a separate episode in its own right.
Yeah, let's do that as a separate episode. Yeah, we'll talk about our best and maybe even our worst as well.
Yeah, why not? Why not?
We don't want Johnny Nelson to be listening, do we?
John, thank you so much for your time. Ian, likewise, it's been a pleasure. John, it's been good to hear you in this one. You were rather muted with the brilliant Barry McGuigan last time, so it's good to have you up and fighting fit heading into 2023. guys, thank you so much for joining us on Ringside Rewind. If you are enjoying this podcast, please go and rate it and review it on the podcast platform that you choose to listen to it on, and spread the word and share the links to Ringside Rewind. This is me, Tris Dixon, and I've been joined, as always, by the brilliant Ian Dark and John Rawling.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.